die, Carter, is nothing less. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something had missed me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that? Become yourself. Name God and the devil so better. I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lines to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb. And you must learn what it means to become responsible. This is an exact right. And that is why you are here.
This is Henrik. A warm welcome to everyone wherever you are, and of course whenever you're listening to this program. Thank you for tuning in. As you regular listeners know, we who present the material don't necessarily accept or reject the viewpoint presented. We highlight them because, we think they are fascinating, and let's face it, to challenge the principles that we've been taught is a must in these confused and unbalanced times. But just because it's oppositional, just because it's contrarian, doesn't automatically make it right. So we ask you to keep an open mind, use your discernment and rationality, and as always, we ask you to make up your own mind. And furthermore, I find that few alone, on their own, hold and present the entire picture, at least as I see it. We take a little bit of this, a little bit of that, from him, from her. We blend it with our own ideas and thoughts and come to a unique viewpoint. We have enough of repeaters in the world as it is, and I say thank God we don't all agree. How boring and pointless would that be? Okay, so today we have Russell Targ with us. He's a physicist, scientific researcher, and author whose pioneering contributions to laser and laser communications has earned him two National Aeronautics and Space Administration Awards, two NASA Awards. He holds a bachelor's degree in physics from Queen's College and did graduate work in physics at Columbia University. Targ has published over 100 scientific papers on lasers, plasma physics, and ESP research. In 1972, Targ co-founded and worked for the innovative CIA-sponsored Stanford Research Institute, SRI, where psychic abilities were tested for two decades. Targ retired as a senior staff scientist from Lockheed Martin Missiles and Space Company in 1997. His latest book, The Reality of ESP, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities, comprehensively details the recently declassified data collected at SRI, as well as serving as a guide to allow everyone to tap into their own psychic potentials. He teaches remote viewing workshops worldwide and has co-authored 8 books on the topic of psychic abilities. Today, we're going to talk about the inception of the remote viewing program at SRI and the reality of extrasensory perception. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio, Russell Targ. Nice of you to come on our program talking with us today. We really appreciate it. I hope everything is good with you over on the California side, as it were, today.
I'm very happy to chat with you today.
Excellent. This is going to be very interesting. I'm so curious to, well, a lot of things of much of the research that you've been involved in and spearheading with so many other people, of course, but I'm curious to hear about the inception of SRI specifically, how it all got started, how you, together with Hal Puthoff, if this is how it happened, managed to interest the government and various official authorities, if you will, of looking into quote-unquote fringe science. How did it begin?
Well, I had a lifetime interest in psychic stuff and magic. So when I was a graduate student in physics, I was doing magic on the stage in New York. So, every young person likes to have a chance to fool adults. and I was doing stage magic for parties and art openings and bar mitzvahs and that kind of thing. Just regular stage magic, pretending to read the minds of people in the audience. And what I discovered is that from time to time, when I would be standing on the stage with my eyes closed and the lights, pretending to read somebody's mind, I would get a visual impression of what their house looked like or what they were thinking about. So while I was doing a ordinary trick, magic trick, I would be given some psychic information that the person would then verify, and everyone would be quite surprised that some genuine ESP showed up in my magic show. And as a young scientist, I began to get more interested in the genuine ESP that would creep into my show instead of just furthering sleight of hand. So I began to familiarize myself with the work in professional parapsychology that was being done at Duke University. And I met J.B. Ryan and had a chance to talk with him, and moved from stage magic to building an ESP teaching machine. Eventually, I got to take that machine to a meeting of NASA luminaries with Wernher von Braun and Arthur C. Clarke and the administrator of NASA, and I was able to convince them in 1972 to give me some money to start a program at Stanford Research Institute.
Wow.
So it was really my very interesting ESP teaching machine that Wernher von Braun did very well with that was the key to getting money for our program. And I can tell you at the outset that ESP teaching machine was something we worked with for a year at Stanford Research Institute, and I'm now offering it as a free iPhone application. So you can download my little game called ESP Trainer at no cost from the application store.
Interesting. What does it do? What are some of the properties of this little teaching thing?
It's a four-choice random number generator. So you open the game, and it gives you four squares, red, green, blue, and yellow, and it already has one of them chosen. If you press the square the machine has chosen, it will ring a very nice chime and show you an interesting photograph of some world historical site as a reward. And if you don't press the right one, it will show you what had been the right one and invite you to try again. So it gives you 25 trials and counts the number of trials that you've done and the number of hits you've gotten, and then it makes some comment about how well you did. Whether it's a good beginning, or whether ESP ability is present, or whether you're a psychic medium and an oracle. So it's just a game, but the point of the game is that people are able to develop their psychic abilities and learn what it feels like when they're in touch with their ESP. So it's an ESP teaching machine.
Right, very good. Let's back up a little bit again here then. I mean, obviously, as you said, you had a knack, if you will, then, for remote viewing. You have extrasensory perception maybe above the norm, and we're talking about 1946, I think, when SRI basically got started, right? And Wernher von Braun is in there, NASA and everything. What do you think that they wanted to see come out of their investment? Did they have any expectations?
Well, see, our program started at NASA in 1972.
Okay.
Is the beginning of our program. Indeed, SRI started in 46, but I didn't get there until 30 years later.
Okay.
So I was at this interesting conference on speculative technology in 72, and that was the impetus to starting the program. That is, at SRI is like a farmer's market. You can do pretty much whatever you want if you bring money.
Okay.
So, meeting with von Braun and the NASA administrator gave me the entree to then come to SRI with an astronaut. Edgar Mitchell came with me and said, NASA supports this work. We think you should have a program. And that was the beginning of the program.
And did you report with results to anybody specifically?
Oh, of course. Well, we did our first year program for NASA, showing that people could learn to develop their psychic ability, as we are still doing with this little game. And we also did a brainwave experiment where lights would be flashed in the eyes of a sender person in a shielded room, and we'd measure the brainwaves of his friend in another room. And what we would find is that when the lights were flashed in my eyes, my friend's brainwaves would change. And this was a formal experiment, and that was very successful, and we replicated the following year. And what it shows is that there is a direct physiological connection you can show between the thoughts of one person and the experiences of a distant person. And we published that in the Proceedings of the Electrical Engineering Society in America. And other people have now done that's becoming a favorite experiment.
Ah, okay.
Because it's a very clean experiment. You don't have to do a lot of statistics. I would sit in my little room with a magnetically operated flash lamp, having lights annoyingly shine in my eyes, and my friend in an electrically shielded copper room, her brain waves would be knocked out of the alpha state during those periods when I was suffering the flashing light. So it's a very clear experiment.
So we also have involved in this, of course, CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and we hear a lot about so-called ESP spies, right, spying on the enemy and stuff like that. Is there anything you want to talk about pertaining to that?
Well, I can talk about the work that has become declassified. So in my new book, The Reality of ESP, we're able to talk about the things that had previously been secret, and now they're declassified. So in the beginning of our program, we had evidence for people's ability to describe what's going on in a distant place, and we call that remote viewing. The ability that a person has to quiet their mind and then describe and experience what's happening at a distant location, even in the future. So people are able to experience what's happening in the distance and in the future. And we got very good at doing that experiment, a kind of psychic hide-and-go-seek. Every day, my partner, Hal Putoff, would be taken away to a randomly chosen location in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and then one or another of the psychics with whom we were working would have to describe what it looks like and what he's doing at this location. And some of the people were able to do that very, very well. As we worked with one person named Pat Price, who is a police commissioner of the city of Burbank, California. And Price was able to describe very accurately when Hal was at the water. He described little boats and the mast jetty sticking out into the water. When he went to Hoover Tower, he described Hoover Tower. So that later on, when somebody had to match up Price's 9 descriptions against the photographs of where Hal was taken, then they got 7 out of 9 matched in first place. Which is to say, if Hal was kidnapped by terrorists 9 days in a row, we would have found him the first place we looked using Pat Price's psychic data.
Hmm.
So CIA said, that looks pretty exciting. We will support your work to investigate this. And the deal we made with the CIA, so the deal we made with the devil, is that we would spend half of our time doing operational things for the CIA, looking for hostages, looking in on China and Iran and the Soviet Union, and we would spend half of our time doing experimental research that we could publish in the world scientific journals. And we worked in that way with the CIA for more than 20 years, half our time doing operational things, half our time trying to understand the nature of psychic ability. And in my new book, I'm able to describe the material we did for the CIA, which had previously been classified secret. So that's a kind of breakthrough event for me, that as I worked with the CIA through Freedom of Information in the United States and was able to publish a great deal of what we did for the CIA, where we would find, we would look in at the American hostages in Iran. We found we were asked to find a kidnapped American officer in Italy, American General Dozier, who Joe McMonagall was able to actually name the street corner where the man was carried to. And we described a Soviet weapons factory in the Soviet Union very, very accurately.
And all of these, Russell, are documented then, if you will, when you were doing this?
Absolutely. As we show the original documentation from the CIA, and we show what the person described.
Very interesting.
So people can look into the distance and into the future. One of the striking things that we did was to describe a Chinese atomic bomb test 3 days before it occurred. And our psychic was Ingo Swan, who is the one who taught us all how to do remote viewing. Swan was the formative person in the 20th century teaching remote viewing. So he was able to look into the future and describe that he saw a kind of pyrotechnic display with colored hemispheres going up in the air and a line of trucks off in the distance. And from that, the CIA could tell that indeed there would be an atomic bomb test, but it would fail, because what Swan described was the burning of uranium in the atmosphere, which is what you get when you try an atomic bomb and it fails. So uranium burns in a kind of pyrotechnic manner, like 4th of July, but no mushroom cloud. So, of course, we did not know we were looking at China, and we didn't know we were looking at a bomb test, but Ingo Swan described the whole thing.
Very interesting.
Swan is a New York artist, a visionary artist who still lives in New York, and he taught Hal Puthoff and me, both physicists, he taught us how to do remote viewing. Hal and I then taught quite a number of people, including 6 United States Army intelligence officers at Fort Meade in Maryland, and started a psychic Army Corps, or an Army Psychic Corps, in 1978. And that ran for another 20 years. So Swan taught Hal and me, Hal and I taught the Army, and the Army taught the world. So one of the things that's interesting is that many people don't believe that there is such a thing as psychic ability. But if you go to Google and search on remote viewing, which is what we're doing, you find that there's more than 2.5 million pages dealing with remote viewing, what it is and how to find a teacher. So it's quite a lot of information for something that many people don't think exists.
Well, indeed. I mean, and I want to, you know, stay on some of the points that you mentioned already, but just let's proceed on this for a little bit. We hear now then that the whole remote viewing program has been put off, if you will, by the military. They're not involved in this at this point anymore. Do you believe that's true, or have they carried on the work?
In 1995, the head of the CIA, Robert Gates, terminated our program. He said on public television that the Berlin Wall is down and America doesn't need any psychic core anymore, because the CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency were teased by the fundamentalists in Congress over doing ESP research. ESP is still not recognized as a bona fide scientific discipline, so in order to do applied ESP in the Army or with the police, you're always subject to uninformed people teasing you. So the Cold War was over, and Gates said, we don't need psychics anymore. So that was the end of our program, and he also closed down the Army program at Fort Meade. Now, of course, there might still, we did very good work for the fact that the Army supported us for 23 years is indication by itself that we were probably doing something useful.
Well, exactly, yes.
So they shut us down after 23 years, but it's possible, of course, that something is still going, some research or applications is still going on in the basement of the Pentagon, and I don't know anything about it. My guess is that there is no program because it required a unusual constellation of courageous and intelligent people in the government to support our program and work with us. And the government these days has not distinguished itself by either its intelligence or its courage. So my guess is that there is no program right now.
Hmm. I know that there's been releases by DARPA, who allegedly is working on technology, basically, to predict the future. There are a number of companies that have submitted suggestions, I think, to DARPA because they were interested in this. I don't know how well that works, but in a sense, that is a continuation of the of a version of that program, nonetheless.
Well, it's certainly true that the future can be known. That is one of our most celebrated experiments was forecasting changes in the silver commodity market, investigating silver futures. And we did that in 1982, each working with an experienced psychic. Each week for 9 weeks, we would forecast whether the silver market was going up a little or up a lot, or down a little or down a lot. And then we would invest based on what the psychic said. And we were correct all 9 weeks in a row. We did it 9 times in a row without error and made $120,000, which was a lot of money back in the 1980s. And BBC Horizon made a film about us called The Case of ESP, and we're on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. So we were quite celebrated at that time. The following year, our investor wanted us to do it twice as quickly so that our viewer did not get feedback from trial one until after he had done trial two, and that was not successful.
Hmm.
But in following years, working with two other people, and I and another woman who is an experienced healer, we did a dozen trials, and we were successful 11 out of 12 tries. So it shows that even a scientist can be psychic if you do the experiment carefully.
Mm-hmm.
So the future can be known.
Well, indeed, it's some fascinating examples, of course, that you have in the new book, and you know, you state some cases from Ingo Swann and some that you and Puthoff has done as well. I just want to go back to one point you mentioned earlier, and that was the idea you said that you made a deal with the devil, the CIA. Now, there's of course many who would agree with that, but you did not have this approach to the CIA at the time you began working for them, correct?
Well, Hal and I had done quite a number of remote viewing trials. We had done two formal series showing that people in the laboratory can quite accurately describe what it looks like where somebody is hiding or even where they will be at a later time. Probably the most interesting thing that I could tell you, the most interesting thing that I know as a scientist, is that it's no harder to describe something in the future than it is to describe something that's distant from you. So that in workshops that I do, I will frequently tell people, I have an interesting object in my briefcase here. Can you describe my object? And they can do that quite well. Later on in the workshop, I will say, I have 6 large paper bags here, each with an object. I want you to describe the object that I'll show you, and after you're all done with your descriptions, someone will then throw a die on the floor, and that will choose the bag I'm going to used to produce an object. So at the time they're doing the description, no one knows the answer. You understand what I'm describing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
So to describe the object I'm going to show you, it'll be chosen by the throw of a die. Consequently, no one knows what it is right now. That experiment works just as well as the object of the briefcase trick. So the most interesting thing that I know is the future is just available. The future is just as available to your psychic sense as the hidden present. And that's why we call psychic abilities a non-local ability. Non-locality is a very hot topic in modern science, modern physics. It was first described by Schrodinger in the 1920s. It's the idea that in some cases, elementary particles that are born together can travel away from each other at the speed of light, and if you grab one, you affect the other. And Einstein said that that's impossible. That's where the idea of spooky connection at a distance came from. So Einstein did not like the idea that things separated by the speed of light could still interact. But by the 1970s, that had been demonstrated. So modern science no longer is arguing about non-local interactions. So when we say that psychic ability is non-local, what we mean is that things that appear separated from one another in space and time can, in some cases, be profoundly connected. So we say that ESP is a non-local ability. It makes it seem less magical.
Right, exactly. I mean, modern physics has quite a bit to say about psychic abilities and remote viewing overall, and it seems to be the more and more and further we go in science, the more and more we realize that this might actually be working. I mean, someone like you doesn't have to be convinced about that, but if science proceeds far enough, do you think that they will end up at the same conclusions, basically, as they go?
Well, I certainly think so. That is, in my book, In the Reality of ESP, I talk about a physicist's proof of psychic abilities. And my argument is that the statistical evidence for work that we have done for 20 years at Stanford and work that other people have done all over the world, the statistical significance of our work is comparable to what is normally accepted to prove anything. For example, in America, the National Institutes of Health did research to investigate whether aspirin would prevent heart attacks. And as you know, we're all now taking aspirin in the morning to stave off the recurrence of heart attacks because aspirin thins the blood and is thought to prevent heart attacks and extend your life.
Hmm.
Now, and that experiment with the aspirin was so significant that the National Institutes of Health stopped the experiment so as not to deprive the control subjects from this beneficial aspirin.
Okay.
The statistical significance of ESP is 10 times greater than the statistical significance of the aspirin experiment. So the whole world feels we've proved aspirin is good for your health, and the evidence for ESP is 10 times as likely as aspirin.
Hmm.
That's why I would say that we have proved something.
Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about the non-local mind and how you see this actually working. This is about clearing your mind. I mean, in another sense, remote viewing has been, I forget the phrase now, but it's basically about not being distracted by other things. So it is kind of destined that some people will be better at it than others. But in your view, can anybody become a talented, a good remote viewer?
Anybody can learn enough about psychic abilities and remote viewing so they can begin to incorporate psychic abilities into their lives. Now, remote viewing is like any other human enterprise. Some people will be better at it than others. For example, I recently had a very nice piano in my house, and I practiced diligently, and I learned to play a little Bach on the piano, and that made me very happy. But it's not going to get me to Carnegie Hall. In fact, it was clear to me that no matter how much I practiced, I was not going to get very far, even though I enjoyed it, because although I'm a music lover, I have no talent at all. Too bad. But I can indeed play a little bit. And remote viewing is like that. That is, some people will quickly develop their ability and be on their way to concertizing in Carnegie Hall. Some people are not so good, but everybody has a ability to develop their psychic functioning to some degree. That is, people can learn to quiet their minds and make use of this ability for things like finding their car keys or looking for a parking place or even investing in the stock market, and there will be a variation in abilities. That is, before you ask your Uncle Harry to forecast the stock market for you, you want to make sure that he actually has psychic ability.
Right.
But what we find is that although you can use this for forecasting the stock market, in my opinion, the principal value of psychic ability is it gives you a new and broader picture of who you might be. See, after spending a decade sitting in the dark, helping people develop their psychic abilities at SRI, it became clear to me that there is much more to people's awareness than what they see in the mirror in the morning. If you think that who you are is what you see in the mirror, then you're in for a lot of suffering, as the Buddhists would say. And what's clear is that people can quiet their mind and experience what's happening in the distance and in the future. So it's obvious that there's more to you, more to one, than the meat and potatoes that you encounter with your own physicality. Does not require that you believe in God. Not require that you believe in anything. It is obvious from the work that we've done that there's much more to one's existence and one's awareness than what you see in the mirror. So it's leads me at least to see a correspondence between our work that we publish in Nature magazine or Physical Review or the other places we've published, the big correspondence between what we see in the laboratory and what the Buddhists have been saying for thousands of years.
Right.
You were talking about quieting your mind. You asked about quieting your mind. In the 8th century Buddhist Dharma master, Padmasambhava, the historical person who brought Buddhism from India to Tibet, said that if you don't like suffering, then you can learn to move from what he called conditioned awareness, which is the awareness where you spend time defending the story of who you are, basically defending your business card.
Mm-hmm.
You can move from conditioned awareness to timeless awareness, which is his word, the 8th century, and you have to give up your desire to name things and grasp onto them and move into the realm where you experience things as they really are, and then you can heal the sick and diagnose illnesses, see into the distance, see into the future, and that's all available. And since you're no longer looking for applause and defending your story, you can move from conditioned awareness to one where you're not suffering. And many people over the millennia have found that a compelling argument.
Indeed. Now, what do you think that, how would you describe the non-local mind and what that is when someone is tapping into it, when they're remote view? What is it? How is it possible?
The non-local mind is the awareness independent of space and time. As we sit here and quiet our mind, I can hold up an interesting object. So I pick up an interesting object from my tabletop, and I would tell you, I'm holding this unusual object that you can describe. If you quiet your mind, I would say to you, tell me about the surprising image that pops into your awareness. I say, don't name it. Don't try and grasp onto it, because naming is impossible psychically. Naming is an analytic task, and psychic functioning is non-analytic. I would say, with your non-local awareness, it's independent of space and time, tell me about the surprising image that just popped into your awareness. And if you did that, you would then describe my object, and the only way you could describe that is with your non-local awareness, your awareness that transcends space and time. And the model is not that you have to reach out from your studio to my home, but rather there's no distance for consciousness. Separation is an illusion. Buddhists talked 2,000 years ago about the idea that separation is an illusion.
Mm.
That there's many bodies, but one consciousness, the teaching.
So Russell, let me ask you this, though. Does it entail that you're sitting there on the other end, and if you will, then in your mind's eye, if you will, describing the object, you know what you're holding, so do you, quote-unquote, project that into the non-local mind, and that's also what I'm then tapping into to be able to see it, or how does that work?
Well, you would have three channels to get my object. One is the mind-to-mind connection that you suggested, mental telepathy. I can visualize an object, and your mind and my mind have some contiguity so that you could see the thing in my mind as one possibility.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I could have grabbed one of my shopping bags off the floor, as it were, and said, there's an interesting object in this bag. I don't know what it is. Can you describe what's in the bag? That would be like the CIA going to us and say, a Russian airplane has crashed in North Africa. Nobody knows where it is. Can you tell us where we should go to get the airplane before the Russians? That would be a pure clairvoyant experiment. And we did that successfully. No one knew where it was, but two of our psychics independently marked a map and described accurately enough so that the CIA could send a team and locate that. And Jimmy Carter on television gave us credit for doing that exact thing. And that would be a clairvoyant experiment. Nobody knew the answer. Or a third opportunity would be, I know you're having trouble visualizing my object, but I'm going to show it to you or describe it to you or tell you what it is in just a few minutes so that if you look into your future, when I describe this thing to you, you will then have a perfect mental picture of my object looking into the future, the precognition. And precognitive remote viewing works excellently. So in this instance, you would have three different channels. You would have the direct mind-to-mind connection with me, mental telepathy. You would have the direct connection with the mystery object, which is clairvoyance. And you'd have the ability to read your own mind in the future, which is precognition. And all of those work independently of one another, and they can work together so that the easiest thing to do, in my experience, is describe the object that I know about and which I'll show you at a later time. So that would be the starting thing I would do with a workshop. Tell me what I've got in the briefcase, and I know the answer. Of course, that's not a double-blind experiment.
Right.
So I always... like I could theoretically whisper the object to you or make hand signals to tell you what it is. So at the end of a workshop, each person will have their unique picture in an envelope, and they will then have to describe that picture and then choose which one of four other possible pictures replicates the one in the envelope. So chances are one in four of doing that correctly. And after a weekend of doing remote viewing with me, people are able to do that quite well.
So you can train yourself and basically doing it over and over again, and some people are going to get better and better at it, basically.
Yes, I have a whole chapter in my book telling people how to work with a friend so that each of you can help one another in developing this ability. The idea is that we all have the ability. That I'm not teaching anybody to be psychic. I'm telling you the moves to make to quiet your mind and make use of the ability you already have.
I see. Now, let me ask you this. In the book, you have a short section on the what you call the earliest remote viewing experiment, going back to the Oracle at Delphi, of course. And there are some people who believe that there was actually, quote-unquote, sacred sacraments involved in her ability to prophesy and have these visions and stuff like that. Was this anything that you did at the SRI? And we hear about LSD being used in certain experiments and things like that. Did you guys ever, were you involved in that kind of work?
Well, we did not use any flashing lights or drugs.
Nothing like that.
In our work. Things like marijuana or LSD may cause a person to feel psychic, but unfortunately there's no evidence that ESP is enhanced by marijuana or by LSD. There's some theory that one of the components of ayahuasca makes you psychic.
Mm-hmm.
It's called harmaline. Is one of the two components of ayahuasca, whose name is harmaline, and some people sometimes call it telepathine, and there's interest in that, the harmaline component of ayahuasca.
Yeah.
I have no experience at all with that. I do have some experience with MDMA, the drug called ecstasy, and I have had personal experience of guessing playing cards correctly, which is a very difficult thing to do. I would never do that in an ESP experiment. For one reason or another, in one of my first MDMA experiences, somebody wanted me to guess some cards, and I guessed three cards in a row, suit and number correctly, which is a very difficult task. I've never done that since. But I think that MDMA probably has the ability to quiet your mind and relax you.
Yeah.
But since ecstasy is illegal in the United States, I am not encouraging anybody to break the law, because going to jail is too high a price to develop your psychic ability. It's not necessary.
All right, very good. Now, there's so many interesting aspects in the book. There's so many things I want to discuss with you. We're going to take a break here in 5 or so minutes. But before we do that, why don't you tell us about the kidnapping of Patty Hearst briefly in that case?
Well, that's one of the two events that allows me to say I am completely convinced the reality of psychic ability. One of the things that convinces me is standing with my friendly psychic 9 weeks in a row, as he would tell me whether the silver market is going up a little or up a lot or down a little or down a lot. And he did that 9 times in a row, and we really made money and greatly astonished a lot of people, including our stockbroker. That's one of the things that convinces me of ESP. The odds of that are approaching 1 in a million to do that 9 times in a row. The other thing was the Patty Hearst adventure. Patricia Hearst was the daughter of the publisher of the San Francisco Examiner, William Randolph Hearst. And she, of course, was an heiress. The Hearst family is a very wealthy California family. And Patricia Hearst was an 18-year-old undergraduate at the University of California in Berkeley, not far from where I live and not far from Stanford Research Institute. And Patty Hearst was kidnapped from her studio apartment in Berkeley, and she's kidnapped by an organization who called themselves the Sudanese Liberation Army, the SLA. And they were holding her, and they wanted the Hearst family to contribute money and food to feed the poor. That was the deal.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the police had no idea where she went at all. It was a total mystery. The kidnapper shot up the neighborhood, and everybody was frightened about the whole scenario. They're so frightened that one day after the Patricia Hearst was kidnapped, the Berkeley Police Department called us at Stanford Research Institute and said, could your psychics help us find the heiress? So the following day, my colleague Hal Putoff and I and the psychic policeman Pat Price drove to Berkeley. And as we walked in, Pat Price, a no-nonsense Irishman, said, let me see your mug book. It's a picture book that every police station has with pictures of the usual suspects. So they pulled down this large loose-leaf binder and put on a big wooden table, and Price stood there and turned the pages, which had four photographs to a page, and he turned many, many pages and then came to a page and said, put his finger on the face of one man and said, that's the ringleader. And he put his finger on the face of Donald DeVries, who, of course, we had never heard of. But the police said, oh, yeah, we know him. We haven't seen him for a year because he walked away from a minimum security prison. He escaped, just walked away. And we haven't seen him for a year, but we know who he is. It'll be interesting if he shows up. They sort of weren't excited that Price said that that's the ringleader because we couldn't verify it. They said, well, can you tell us where the kidnapped car is? And Price said, oh, yes, I can do that. And he pointed north, and he said, if you go north about 50 miles, on the right side of the road, the freeway, to the diner, and the white station wagon next to the diner, and across the freeway, there's two large gas storage cylinders, and the pedestrian overpass that crosses the freeway. You can't miss it. So one of the detectives said, well, I know where that is. It's on the way to my house in Vallejo, Northern California. They dispatched a police car, and within 10 minutes, they called us back and said, we've got the car, and we're sure it's the right one, because there's cartridges rolling around on the floorboards of the automobile that match the cartridges we saw on the floor in Patricia Hearst's apartment, on the floor under her bed. So we knew that Price had identified the car, and that took essentially no time. As soon as they asked him where the car was, our cheerful policeman said, drive north 50 miles, you'll find it by a diner on the right. So that's the kind of thing that makes me convinced that some people are in control of their expanded awareness and just live in this non-local space-time and can incorporate that into their lives.
Indeed. Very good, Russell. One more thing before we take a short break. A point I want to return to that we didn't kind of clear up earlier. I was asking about the CIA that they've, you said effectively you made a deal with the devil. Tell us a little bit more about that and why you say that today.
Well, they made a deal with the devil because the CIA does not have a good reputation in the United States. The parts of the CIA have done many, many reprehensible things and killed people and toppled governments. They're responsible for killing Allende, who was the president of Chile in the early 1970s. The CIA have done a lot of terrible things. So a mild-mannered researcher does not want to say, well, I'm giving up my laser research and I'm going to go work for the CIA. They say, well, why are you doing that? And the deal was, we had research we wanted to do pertaining to human beings' expanded awareness, and we needed someone to support us who was not fearful. And CIA is famously not fearful. So Hal and I, in our laser career, that is like in our previous incarnation, we had each done laser applications for the government, for the CIA. We had built stuff that the CIA used in their various incarnations. So they knew who we were. So we were able to get a hearing with the Director of Intelligence for the CIA, and we showed him our research results. And he said, well, if you can describe one of the places we're most interested in the Soviet Union, we'll support your work. And we said that, well, the deal we'll make with you, we're not going to go to work full-time for the CIA. We didn't go to graduate school to be psychic spies for the CIA. But if you will support our work, we'll spend half the time bringing you information, because as scientists, we're actually in favor of intelligence rather than ignorance. We think intelligence is a good idea in the Cold War. And we will do that for half the time. And the other half the time, we want to be able to make scientific inquiries into how ESP works, and we want to publish those findings. And the deal we made is the CIA would let us do research and publish it. We just had a promise not to mention their name.
Hmm.
And that was the deal we made.
So in hindsight, Russell, was it worth it to give this extraordinary research to the quote-unquote devil?
Well, it was certainly worthwhile because we were very well paid. The research was well funded. We've got to do more or less whatever we wanted to for 20 years. And as a scientist, it's very, very difficult to get your work continuously funded and renewed year after year to follow a research plan for 20 years. The scientist is very, very fortunate to find this continuity of research support. And for two decades, we found missing captives, kidnapped victims, missing airplanes, all sorts of different things for the government that couldn't have been done any other way, and they allowed us to continue to publish our work. So everybody kept their bargain.
I see. All right, well, we're going to continue to talk more. We're going to take a short break here at this point, but again, I want to give out the title of the book that we're talking about, The Reality of ESP, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities. Now, where do people go, Russell, to pick up a copy of this book?
Well, the easiest place to get that is from Amazon, of course, and you can buy it as a paperback book or as a Kindle from them, and you can also get more info by going to my website, which is espresearch.com. And if you go to my website, you can communicate with me, and I will frequently answer your questions.
Very good, espresearch.com. You have a lovely picture of yourself and your cat there on the page as well, by the way. I love that cat. Good looking
cat.
Thank
you. Very psychic.
Oh,
black
yeah.
Cat.
I don't doubt it. Cats are incredibly, coherent in picking up intention and everything else. I don't doubt it. All right, well, Russell, we'll take a short break at this point. Stay with us. We'll be back with more in a little bit. If you're new to the program, we have more radio available for you to stream or download at redicecreations.com. We cover all kinds of topics. We have a busy news section and we produce other content as well. So please check out our iPhone and Android apps. We have RSS feeds, a bi-weekly newsletter, Facebook page, YouTube channel, Twitter feed, the works, to make it accessible for you. We are going to continue to talk with Russell Targ in our second hour. We have this continuation archived on our members' website, redicemembers.com. A subscription will get you full access to all our programs. We have a few different subscription choices for you, whatever works for you. We are an independent, listener-supported program that spares you from commercial interruptions and advertisements. You can sign up for a three-month subscription and download everything on our website if you so please. It's a great service that has brought together some of the most extraordinary researchers on a ton of different topics. Our next program features part two with Olle Dammegård on the assassination of Olof Palme. We have Lynn Picknett on Lucifer Revised, and then Randall Carlson back again, this time on sacred geometry. As we continue with Russell Targ in the second hour, he'll ask me about the object he held in his hand. It's my first, well, I guess, psychic or remote viewing session, I guess we could call it, so you'll get the result of that. We talk about psychic defense, healing, and hurting from a distance, theosophy, and early scientific discoveries made by remote viewing. Russell also talks a little bit about what SRI International is up to today. It's an interesting continuation, so don't miss it. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com is where you can find more. We'll be right back.